Are you seeking more creativity in your life? Join us, Nadia and me, Laura, the hosts of the Creative Rumble podcast.
Each week, we delve into the minds of inspirational creatives, share their wisdom and our own creative journeys. We explore how to align yourself, develop creative ideas, and find inspiration.
Join us as we explore what it takes to live a creative life so you too can feel the creative rumble.
Living a creative life is for everyone. Let's Creative Rumble.
The Creative Rumble podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of this country and recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' continuing connection to land, sea, waterways, sky and culture. We pay respects to elders, past, present and emerging. Welcome to the Creative Rumble podcast, where we plunge headfirst into the vibrant world of creativity and theatre. Today, we're thrilled to welcome a true luminary, Emma Sproul, a seasoned and award-winning force in the theatre scene. Emma is the mastermind behind Dionysus Theatre, a modern company she founded back in 2011 on the picturesque Mornington Peninsula. With her visionary leadership, Emma has steered the ship through numerous productions and initiatives over the past decade. From the beloved annual festivals Ariete and Sock and Buskin to gripping mainstage productions like Exit the King, Blood Wedding and Romeo and Juliet, Emma's portfolio brims with innovation and artistic brilliance. Under Emma's stewardship, Dionysus Theatre isn't just a theatre company, it's a beacon of creativity and inclusion. Based in Frankston, but with a reach that spans far beyond, Emma ensures that the company is a melting pot of talents from Melbourne and beyond. Inspired by the cradle of Western theatre, Dionysus Theatre takes its name from the Greek god of revelry, reflecting its ethos of celebrating creativity and pushing boundaries. Emma's creative prowess hasn't gone unnoticed, earning her accolades from luminaries like Coral Druin of Stage Whispers, who hails her as one of the most innovative directors in the world of community theatre. Emma's productions, such as the electrifying Exit the King, carves the path for theatrical excellence. Emma fearlessly redefines the theatrical experience, making it dynamic and immersive from transforming spaces and challenging traditional conventions. As a visionary leader and creative powerhouse, Emma Sproul also is an educator with 25 years currently as head of the drama program at McClellan College and also runs the community collective The Book Club. Where does she find the time? Prepare to be inspired as we sit down for an enlightening conversation with Emma Sproul only on the Creative Rumble podcast. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you, Laura, for having me and for such a glowing and almost overwhelming introduction. I now need to gather myself ready to speak to the person you just introduced to the world.
I think that's you. It really is. I wouldn't have said it otherwise.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And if I can make you get a copy of that perhaps and use it as a morning mantra to face the world. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Actually, another guest asked for their intro and I feel like that could be, that's your mantra. Oh. Sometimes it's hard to say it about yourself, but other people say it much better. Mm. Yeah. Like I've said it much better. I have. Absolutely. Emma, where are we today? Like I've so privileged to be here in your family space today.
Yes. You've come to visit me in my parents' home that I've come to visit during my holidays. And we're sitting in what is the study. So it's a very comfortable place for me because we are surrounded by books and that's a significant part of my, I guess, personality, my self-identity, that I'm a reader. I've been a reader from a very young age and I particularly enjoy, as we know, social media has a lot of problems, but it also has a lot of reassurance and validation, and I love a lot of the commentary that crops up about it doesn't matter if you have a lot of books that you've never read. They're furniture, they're an aesthetic design choice, and they also represent the learning you are aiming for or the skills you may acquire or the opportunity to grab something if your life turns a corner that would now be a reference that you needed. You don't need to have said, I have read all of these books. What matters is that you have them and that they are there and they surround you as both possibility and potential. So, yeah, being in a room of books is probably a good place for me today, and you're very welcome to be in this space with me.
I really like this space. So for our listeners, behind where I'm sitting, there is a really – is it like what sort of wood timber is it? But it's, you know, some heavy timber bookshelves filled with books. And I think I remember I was reflecting before when I was setting up that this bookshelf was maybe in the main living space of – where you used to live, your family lived in Burnie?
No, they did actually have a library. What had once been the spare bedroom became a library, and so that's when Mum and Dad bought these three beautiful dark wood stained bookcases to then sort of place most of the book collection, not all of it, but most of it in there. But there was also a lovely huge bookcase, a standalone bookcase that was in the lounge space, and then a unit like similar to my house. There are books everywhere. So even though I have a designated library, which is essentially a converted garage, but it's my library, there are, like someone joked with me the other day, there are literally books in every room of the house. I have books on shelves in the bathroom. There are shelves in the toilet. The cookbooks are stored in the laundry. there are books in every room of the house.
Oh, wow. And I think that's what grabbed me back many years ago when I saw all of those books, that you could have such that many books in your home. So
so I've literally and figuratively been surrounded by books and reading from my earliest memories.
Well, who's the reader in your family?
Both of them. Dad was perhaps a bit more explicit with his recommendations and modelling of the reading, but no, Mum is equally avid and voracious, that and both of them being primary school teachers, reading was significant. And from my understanding, I started reading at a very young age, but I would also pretend to read. Mum says I had my kids, were all my stuffed toys. I would gather them all around, like probably as an audience, and we won't dwell too long on what perhaps that suggested about future pathways and self-presentation, but I would gather them all around as an audience, and I would have a book. And even though I couldn't actually read the book, I would read the story to them or make up a story as if I were reading it from a book and perform it for my kids. Mum said I was doing that from very young.
Wow.
Wow is one way to put it. Like, otherwise it could be, I see. Could also be responses.
I see that too. Yeah. I'm sure there'll be a few nods from some familiar listeners. It's marvellous. So reading is big for you, and you're running a book club.
Yeah. So that was something I'd always wanted to do, but been hesitant. I think, look, it happened. Should this be relevant? A book club was definitely something I wanted to do anyway. It seemed like this almost exotic concept that, could I have that for myself, you know, sort of unattainable kind of goal. And the moment it did actually happen was at a particularly dark time in my life, and one of the reasons I think I'd been hesitant was like, well, who would come? Who would want to do this with me? Who would, you know, make a monthly commitment? But simultaneously, I was really struggling to feel connected, to feel positive. And I thought, well, I didn't like necessarily social interactions, but I thought, well, if I have a book club, then that is a social interaction I have to have once a month. And then as it happened, a friend of mine, her daughter, we were literally in the line to get books signed at a Jodi Picoult reading book launch. And we started talking about it, and she was keen on a book club as well. I went, oh, my goodness, well, and we'd do it together. And that gave me that sort of confidence to go, all right, well, it's not just me, it's two of us. So, but then she was quite happy that I just took the charge. I organised it, I invited everyone, but it was from the two of us. It wasn't just me. So that was fine. Anyway, so a bunch of people came. It was beautiful. She came to the first one, and then something shifted in her life and she couldn't come anymore. And so it was just me. But there are two others, her mother being one of them. There are two others have been there from the very beginning, and lots of other people have come and gone. Some have returned, and we literally have, what is it? So, yes, it's our 19th birthday this year.
Oh.
So June this year will be our 19th anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So it has actually become a very solid and significant part of my life. So I'm quite chuffed about that. But as with everything else, and we can touch on this later, but again, your beautiful introduction, yes, of course, there is a thread of truth through it in many ways. But I think I sort of feel that sense of okay, yes, that was my idea, or yes, I made that happen, but not individually. Like, those things cannot exist without significant input, support, contribution from others. And the book club's the same. Like, I do host it, I do organise it, but it exists because there is a collective group of people, predominantly but not exclusively women, who commit and engage and return, and that in itself allows that cycle to continue.
So you've met many new people that you so even in that first book club, first few years, that it's evolved.
Yes. Look, because it's, I sort of call it my book club, but it's our book club. But I suppose because it's mine in the sense that I organise and house it, almost every person who comes into it has already had some connection to me. Like, I'll be the, mostly I'll be the person that will have brought someone else in. But even then, sometimes that link to that person could be quite tenuous, and they also may have no connection to anybody else who's there, or sometimes they might come and go, oh, you, I haven't seen you for 4 years, but we have known each other. So there's kind of nice, so there's a bit of a common thread with me as a connection, but I'm not, they're also not dependent on me for that connection.
Yeah.
And
what do you talk, look, this sounds really ignorant, but what do you talk about in a book club, for example? So if any, this is for me and other people who've not been to a book club.
No, that's a great question. And firstly, I'd suggest that every book club will be completely different. But I would say as a general rule, as a, I suppose a more superficial answer, is it's probably equally weighted between literally talking about the book. Did we like the book? Did we like the characters? Did we like the way the story was told? Did we like how it ended? Do we think the author did a good job? Do we feel shortchanged? The actual writing style itself. So the book itself, its issues, its ideas, its characters, its trajectory, we talk about that. But then, as you would expect, as a result of that, there will be significant discussion about broader themes, ergo situations in the world, or even personal associations that the book sparks. You know, so we read, for example, and this is letting you into book club folklore here, in our first year, and I'm going to name her, and one of the three original members, me, Dawn, who is the mother of the other woman who started it with me, and Dawn's a bit like a second mother to me. She's magnificent. and Andrea, a friend of mine, Andrea. So the three of us have been there since June 2005. And in that first year, we read Tuesdays with Murray, which I don't know if you're familiar with the book, but it's one of those books that even if people haven't read it, a lot of them are quite aware of it. Oprah was, I think it was in the very early stages of Oprah's book club, and then Oprah did it on her TV show. Oh, it went everywhere. It got made into a film. It's a true story. It's a guy called Mitch Albom, who was, I believe, a sports journalist, heard that his old uni professor, who he had had a really good relationship with, had become very ill and perhaps didn't have a lot of time left. So he made a point of going and visiting him, and it was just a beautiful visit. And so then it became that each Tuesday he would go and spend time with Murray. And obviously he recorded those sessions, and obviously Murray continues to decline while his mind was amazing and they had these incredibly rich conversations, and Murray had enormous wisdom and insight to impart because he had lived a life of rich experience and all the wisdom that comes with that. He was happily sharing with Mitch, and Mitch was writing this down going, this is amazing, and how fortunate am I to have this person in my life? But simultaneously alongside that, Murray declines and eventually passes away, and all the physical indignities that come with a life that is let down by the by your body. What was that beautiful quote? I think it's a biblical quote, which is not something I'm normally drawn to for a variety of reasons, but my grandfather's funeral, my grandfather passed away of cancer, and yes, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And it's a, and I've never forgotten that quote. I mean, that's it. Like, and also the frustration. I see a lot of that with my father as well, who is now sort of somewhat incapacitated and in aged care because of a stroke. His mind is almost untouched by it. Like the memory, the cognitive function, the wit, the intelligence and passion for science and nature and all the things that he had, still there, but his body doesn't prevent him to live a life at home. And also his lack of speech has completely diminished his sense of self and confidence to interact and see that he still is a person in the world that can contribute. Anyway, so the quote is also very apt for him. Anyhow, so that's sort of the story of Tuesdays with Murray. And so many people, it moves them deeply, and they adore the book. Andrea did not adore the book. Andrea also read the book on the way home from a very long flight from Europe, I think. And it was like, you know, when you have those people who get angry, and even if you have absolutely no agreement in their anger, you don't share that same rage, or they hate something you loved or whatever, their rage is delightful. And whenever Andrea is angry, it's just like you just pull up a chair and go, tell us why you're mad, Andrea. and I provoke her, but, you know, as I said, years on, like, you know, she'll not like a book, but Andrea, better or worse than Tuesdays with Murray? Oh, Tuesdays with Murray, it was garbage. I mean, I Murray obviously was a beautiful person. I appreciate all he gave to the world, but why did I care? I didn't need to hear about it. Certainly not his bowel movements. What did that bring to anything? Anyway, yes. Yeah, so, and he was a sports journalist. Why? So her rage about Tuesdays with Murray has become folklore in book clubs. So there's lots of stuff like that. But similarly, as we spoke about that book, and there were mixed. Some people loved it, some people didn't. Mm. But I think one of the stronger – we only talked about the book for perhaps a short period of time. Very quickly, that book club, we spent a lot of time talking about our own lives and how they shifted with aging parents and what that meant for us. And some of us talked about the loss of grandparents, but some of us who were, you know, because at the time I was younger than I am now, but – you know, there were people who were perhaps my age now that were facing that, well, my parents might have to go into care, or they may have already lost a parent, or what is my responsibility and how do I navigate, et cetera. So on that particular book club, yes, we spent quite a lot of time talking about our own personal experiences of the elements within that particular story. So there's a lot of that. We do books that, which is great, you perhaps wouldn't have otherwise read, so that's really interesting. And even a lot of people don't like a book, some of those are the richest conversations about why you didn't like books. So
that's connections and that conversation and yes, understanding more about yourself through the things that you don't like are quite revealing sometimes, aren't they?
And I think, I suppose the other thing I'd add to that is one thing that I find really valuable about book club is that it, because people have different connections, some people they get on well in book club, but that is the only interaction with that person they'll have. Mm. But there's still real respect. But respect isn't just, well, I respect you and what you think, but it doesn't mean I have to pander to it or be diminished by it. So I really value that people are happy to disagree. People genuinely disagree and challenge and even argue. But it is with a couple of mild exceptions of people that are no longer in the club, which happened organically anyway. Sure. Like that happened organically. Sure. There's never once been anything that was regretted or out of line or problematic. And I think that, and that's been really good for me as well, to go, you can disagree and even argue, but do that within a respectful space, to stand up for yourself and go, I disagree and here's why I disagree, and have that faith and confidence in your own opinion while not diminishing or devaluing the opinion that you are contradicting.
That's a really important point you're raising right now, though, because at the moment we can tend to be afraid a lot to actually speak our mind or say how we feel for fear of offending someone or the greater collective.
Which we can do quite easily because we are learning so quickly and readily, like, oh, this thing that I never would have meant offence by could genuinely be quite offensive, ignorant, diminishing of someone who has an experience that just isn't mine.
Yeah.
I learned a phrase recently that has almost become my mantra, which is intent is not impact. You may not have intended in any way to be offensive, to be hurtful, or to be harmful, but if you were, you have to sit in that and go, okay, well, how do I learn as opposed to be defensive? But I didn't mean it. You knew I didn't mean it. Well, of course you didn't mean it, but it doesn't change the fact. And it also allows you on the other side to go, actually, that really hurt me when that person said that, and not go, oh, they didn't mean it, don't make a fuss. No, let them know, be respectful and go, listen, I understand that's not what you meant, but can I let you know that this is how it made me feel? And I like that enormous parts of our society are focused on that education, that ownership, acknowledging privilege, and then the re-education of yourself, that's your responsibility, in order to rectify a lot of those imbalances that we have just accepted or even perhaps ignored because we weren't directly impacted by them. I think society is moving beautifully, slowly but beautifully, in that direction. But then simultaneously, and I touched on social media before, in so many cases when we are nervous to share an opinion or to contradict or even just challenge, go, can I just ask why you think that? Mm. You know, I'll give the person a chance to validate before you go, oh, yes, I do disagree with you, or maybe I don't now, I understand more information. Mm. But then you contrast that with people on a keyboard on a global scale with right or wrong, that perception that, well, that distance and potential anonymity means I can say whatever I want without fear of consequence. And if I do upset or hurt someone, it's not even on my radar. Mm. So I think we've got quite significant extremes with regard to opinion sharing and challenging. And it'd be nice if we had more discussion and debate than conflict and an attack. But
Thank you for that. And just going, following and continuing on with, you know, the debate and being able to challenge and speak, the theatre does that.
Mm. It's a conversation.
It's a conversation, yeah. And how do you, I mean, you know, you began in the early days surrounded by your wonderful love toys. Look, we've all been there. Don't worry. Your kids, don't worry. We've all been there.
Soon replaced by cats, but go on.
Yeah. How many cats?
More than four, but less than six.
And they're gorgeous.
They are.
So let's talk about the theatre and where you began. And actually, let's just do a full disclaimer of how I know you.
Yes.
We did meet in first year at theatre school back in the mid to late 90s.
Yes, 1995.
1995.
In the Centre of Performing Arts at Launceston University.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Those were the days.
They were indeed the days.
Yeah, shout out to the CPA crew who are out there right now.
Woohoo! Fellow Bachelor of Performing Arts in Theatre alumni. We see you.
We see you. Yeah. Because I got to stay last night with Emma's mum, and while Emma's here staying with her mum, I got to perform a memory that I had of Emma. And I guess, you know, this is one of the things of feeling very comfortable with a friend and being in having that theatre background as well. Suddenly I come alive. You bring it out in me.
It's a gift you can't teach.
But do we tell that story, or was that bonus content we were going to share? It's very in-house, listeners, very in-house. But
I'm going to let you be the judge of that. You decide if and when there is a space or a place for that story in this podcast.
It's a great story. It's really just one of my earliest memories of Emma when we started out at theatre school, and the first week they took us out on a camp and for us to all get to know each other, and it was marvellous. You know, there was some experiences, but one of the key moments where we were getting into small groups and we were to devise work, which is, oh, I love it. Yeah. I can't even remember what we did, my group, but I don't even know who was in my group. Apologies, guys. But
and I don't even know if they gave us any kind of stimulus. I wonder if it was a bit of a site-specific piece. I think we were perhaps told to go away and find a place in that, like it was sort of like a forest.
Yeah.
Like an Australian Australian sort of nature space.
Bushland.
Mm. Standard school camp environment.
Yes.
And
we were like 18, 19, you know.
And so there's a thing, I think we kind of found, each group found their space, and that informed the work.
And you found, and that's, yes, and you found a space that was sort of over the hill a little bit, but your part that you played, the big role, was to
highlight of my career. Nothing I've done since could be measured against.
But you came over that hill, and at the time we were all asked to wear a particular uniform, which consisted of black tights and a black leotard. Mm. And anyway, and here was this wonderful, young, long, blonde-haired woman skipping over the field towards us and summoning us with her body and gestures to come follow her thither. Hither.
I believe there was a jeté in there, at least one.
Oh, there were, definitely. Oh, I can't believe how, you know, memorable this is. But it is, and then there she is dancing along, and we all get up from our seats and we go to follow her. And as she's dancing and jeteing and twirling and bouncing, and then she pauses, quickly pulls her leotards out of her bottom and then proceeds on and jetés and turns. And I just, that moment I went, who is Emma Sproul?
Majestic is, I think, the word.
Luminary.
Unashamed.
Unashamed.
Embracing all the limitations of clothing while always remaining true to the work.
Yeah. But that's one thing I remember about you. Unashamed. You knew what you wanted.
Unaware, but also, yeah.
Well, you know, we were young and bold and well-travelled, I must say.
Yes, yes. Yes. I was particularly well-travelled in that moment,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. You'd been to, I know we're going to talk about the theatre, but you that must also have some relevance as well, being an exchange student in Brazil as well. You spent a year?
Yeah, so I spent a year there. So finished year 12, pretty much went over and lived in Brazil for 12 months, came back and went straight in.
Mm-mm.
Came back and went straight into course.
Yeah.
So, yes, hard to say which was the bigger culture shock, but Brazil probably has a slight edge there. Just pause for Laura to collect herself. I have to quickly share, I think the biggest culture shock, you know when something happens and you're in a room full of people and you collectively feel the room's reaction, not individuals but as a room. And it was such an obvious but also brand new concept with, I don't know if we can, Peter Hammond, one of the key lecturers.
Shout out to Peter Hammond.
Shout out to Peter Hammond. And he made a point, which was an excellent point, because there were however many were there in the course, 25, 30, I don't know. Yes. We're all sitting in this sort of small but lecture space in the very first day. And he said to be ready and to be very clear about why we were there and what we wanted and the work ahead of us. He said, because you'll have all come from your high school programs, your high school drama programs. He said, where you all will have been the star. You've gotten into this course because you will have been the kid at in years 11 and 12, they went, oh, they're the drama student. They're the stars of the musicals and the productions. He said, you were all that in your school and now you're here. He said, and you're not all going to be that here. And it sort of, you could feel the room go, oh. Sort of people instantly sort of shuffling in their heads about, well, where am I going to be and what'll I feel about where I'm going to be? What'll I do to be where I'm going to be? And how am I going to cope if it's not where I thought I'd be? Sort of thing. Yeah. I'd also designed us to, good and bad, instantly look at everybody else in the room that we just had a lovely collegial connection with over several days in this camp and go, oh, there's going to be quite a lot of times over the next 3 years where we're all going to be pitted against one another. We are going to be in competition for things that are important. Anyway, sorry, just wanted to deviate with that.
Well, earlier today you were telling me a story about, I've got so many different thoughts coming up in my head now, you're telling me the story about how as an educator at McClellan College, drama educator, and year sevens, the strategies that you have developed from, you know, you're not just here to be a star. I'm not interested in making you a star. Here's some transferable skills for you.
Yeah.
And then also thinking about our own training and how that happened. And then also thinking from a larger collective of how we view drama, theatre people, theatre school, the weirdness of it all, or, you know, and how that integrates back into, like, how can theatre be more attractive to, you know, particularly because going to the theatre is less more so than it used to be.
Yes.
What, I don't know, I'm making some sort of
No, it's a good, and it's
thread.
A good, and it's not even a question, it's almost like a problem or it's a societal discussion point that keeps happening but needs to be, I suppose, a stronger through line. Because, yes, on a much, much smaller but not insignificant scale, I deal with the problem of arts perception in society in my junior drama classes. And as I was explaining to Laura this morning, the difference between year 7 and 8 drama compared to years 9 and 10 drama, students in a 9-10 drama class have chosen to be there. It's an elective. Whereas every kid has to do 6 months of drama in either year 7 or year 8. And you constantly come up against kids who walk into that space going, I don't want to be here. I don't need to do drama. I don't want to do drama. You can't make me. I don't want to be an actor. I'm not going to get up on stage. I'm not going to do something in front of anyone. And some of them might have even had drama experience. Like, it's an idea. It's a concept they have. Not even, yes, they were forced to do something in grade 6 musicals that has traumatized them. It will be this concept. And sometimes it'll have been fueled by a parent going, oh, don't worry about drama, it doesn't matter. Because there's this perception, and our society, in particular the media in our society, doesn't help this perception, that we put so much weight in the media on celebrity and star that people are absolutely, regardless of what they want to own up to, are obsessed with, are tapped into and consume it voraciously but simultaneously want to diminish it. Who cares about her? What are we, you know, what does that life bother me? And it's like, well, there are actually two very separate things here. There is the celebrity, there is the person, but there's the work, and they aren't the same. And we saw a lot of it. It was particularly interesting and upsetting during COVID and the lockdowns, when obviously live theatre was one of the many things. Talk about mass spread event. Obviously, you could have people sitting side by side in a theatre auditorium. So live theatre absolutely went out the door, and so there was all this, you know, request for support for different industries, and artists were really struggling. And you could see that initial murmuring and often quite confidently out loud voices going, well, it's not an essential industry. We had that essential workers. Well, obviously artists aren't essential workers. And that was horrid, but did also allow that debate to occur, to go, you are all at home, struggling, not coping, limited and disconnected. And what are you doing? You are consuming art. You know, people like to joke about streaming services on Netflix. That's art. Mm-hmm. That's engagement. And at its core, what it is, which is another big part of who I am, it's storytelling. Mm-hmm. Like at its core, what we need and what we yearn for is the telling of stories, and far more complicated than simply being two sides. But on one hand, it is that idea of escapism. If our lives are a bit shit, if they are challenging and overwhelming and we're not coping, that idea that you can flick on a screen that takes you somewhere entirely different, and it still could be a story of substance and depth and intensity and intellectual rigor, or it could be a soap opera, which is by no means a diminished art form, but it allows you to switch off. It's predictable, it's reliable, it's familiar, and it's often overly dramatic. So you can, reality or not, you can pretend it is so far removed from your own life, and that gives you comfort. So you've got that escapism, that alternate world that you can retreat to when your own life is a bit horrid. Mm. But then the other side of it, and there's obviously lots of blurring in between, but the other side of it is, no, you see stories where you go, oh, that's how I feel, or that's my mother, or, oh my goodness, I hadn't seen things from that perspective, but that's what I'm currently dealing with. So again, lots of complexity within between, but people yearn for those stories. They need those stories. We've been telling stories as a human race since the dawn of civilization. That's what we do. We tell stories and we make meaning of our world and our senses of self through the sharing of these stories. And that's art. And yet at that time, people are like, well, art isn't essential. It is. Like, that's how people are remaining functional. And, you know, while no one came out of COVID undamaged, there was significant damage that was avoided by an ability to engage in these stories. And through the fortune that we had that COVID occurred during a time when technology like online existed, then people, you can connect. Not only do you have that own personal connection with a story, but then you can speak to someone else about, how did you find that story? What did you think about that story? What did you think about that character? Like, turning back to the same concept as a book club. So these ideas of stories, and so then throwing it back to junior drama, what I embed within my curriculum and often within my parent-teacher conversations is there are studies, there are a plethora of studies that have looked at drama education and students that have had a rich drama and arts education throughout high school, and they are significantly more successful in their lives, regardless of their chosen field, because of the skills they have gained through that drama education. They may not be actors or even work, and this is the other misconception a lot of people have, they forget that the drama industry is not solely actors. Like, the drama industry could not exist if it was solely actors. There's an enormous amount of roles that are non-acting that are essential and equally creative. But even if you have, you know, you could be an engineer, a real estate agent, a hairdresser, a soccer coach, whatever your chosen profession is, if you've had a rich drama education, your skills will be stronger, you will be more adept at creative thinking, you will certainly be more adept to work with, alongside and lead people, some of whom you personally may not like or respect, but you need to have that civility within this particular framework. You will be able to improvise, think on your feet, and solve a very an unexpected problem quickly. And that idea about being creative, or what's another way we could do this, or what do we do in this moment that isn't what we thought we were going to have to do. The ability to articulate what you think and what you want, to be able to achieve what you know you want to achieve. I could talk for ages about this. Mm. But having to I've really shifted, and the kids still do drama classes. They do drama games and drama skills. It's all a drama experience, but it is completely couched within the understanding of here are the skills you are learning and here is how they will help you. Like this evening as you have an argument with your mother, or tomorrow when you're in maths and you're feeling overwhelmed, but also 5, 10, 15 years from now, here is how these skills will help you. And it's still very much teaching is a constant work in progress. But, yeah, the results I've seen with engagement and quality of work and contributions to discussion, and at the end of every lesson, because the majority of the lesson is practical, at the end of every lesson what the students record in their drama journals, I've really started to see a shift in them understanding that, being able to go, well, this is what's relevant to me. We do a lot of goal setting, because what's relevant to this kid may not be what's relevant to you. And as I said, reflection's a really big part of it. That, well, you may have had a really great lesson, you've had lots of fun playing this game and creating stuff with your mates, and it just felt like you just had fun. But then you sit down at the end and go, but this is what I learned, and these are the skills I demonstrated, and this is what I understand about myself now, and I can carry that into X, Y, and Z. So that's very important to me, because it doesn't just enrich those students, but it also broadens their perspective of their own potential, their own need for creativity and the value it will give them, but also I suppose and hope that open-mindedness, if they do go into a career in real estate, but they may engage with creatives and artists in a professional sphere, and there will be respect for them. Mm. There'll be a deeper appreciation for the work they do and the value it gives the society in which we live, and the necessity of arts in the society in which we live. People like to diminish arts like it is an essential and ignore the fact that they are consuming it constantly, and society would crumble without it, which is not hyperbole, it would. If we suddenly lost arts, we would not function.
Let's talk about the stories that you're telling. And you're telling stories through the theatre as a director. Mm-hmm. You've written work as well.
Yeah, some work, small pieces within the Arete Festival, which is a separate thing. Yeah.
And produced. And also you've challenged traditional spaces from, working with the traditional space, challenging the proscenium art, to working in a digital space during the lockdown period too. So let's talk about Dionysus. I mean, what was really interesting, so everyone, last night I gave Emma a tarot reading. And I have a beautiful tarot deck. And if I've lost you as a listener right now, I apologise. Please come back. But a tarot reading using a Greek mythology tarot deck. And what was really beautiful is that Emma is embedded in this mythology, or the mythology is embedded in Emma. So we'd be reading a card and she'd go off into the story and how that relates back to her. And
what the card represented. And I'm like, yes, but the card has King Theseus. And let me tell you who Theseus was and why he was a bastard. And I think that links back to me in this way. So,
it's fully embedded. And I have full respect for the fact that you have such a deep knowledge of that mythology.
Oh, inconsistent knowledge, yes. Some things I know well, and other things like, sorry, who was he? Sorry, Daedalus, remind me what he did. Something with bread. I don't know. Yeah.
But and Dionysus has been running for many, many years now, and you've established a wonderful team around you, and you're the driving force behind it, part of the committee. So my question is, what are the stories that are coming out that relate back to Dionysus and celebration, revelry?
I suppose, and look, this might be irrelevant, but I just feel I need to say it. I think what's significant, and perhaps what's really quite beautiful about the timing of this interview, because it's come, because COVID hit me hard and it's been difficult to come back and feel as connected to the company, which is significant because the company, it isn't me and only me, but obviously it's it's a part of me.
Mm.
And so feeling detached from the company did feel like a bit of a crisis of self. Mm. And that's very recently been reawakened. And one of the key things I was keen to do was I've always been good with the vision and the idea. I'm not always as strong with the execution, and I'm definitely not as strong with the administration and the production. And as I sort of alluded to before, you can't have one without the – it's great to be an ideas person, but things don't exist with just that. So I thought, wouldn't it be good to maybe step back from that creativity element, which was also validating but exhausting, and I was exhausted in a variety of ways in my life. But then wouldn't it be good if other people are perhaps doing some of that and I support them, which would give me time and space to not only be supporting someone else but be learning about other things that I wasn't always learning about because I was so in the middle of everything, but also the administerial, the production elements of it. Like, well, what does that look like? And that's still quite overwhelming for me. But so I'm not doing things, but the beautiful things you talked about and the work I've done that I'm very proud of, that's a little bit of time ago, and I haven't done anything like that just recently. But I'm at a point now where I'm thinking, well, I might be ready to do that soon, but I'm also exploring this new avenue. So I just felt like that was like, and you can also cut that out if it's not serving the conversation you want to have, but I felt like that was relevant to say because I'm also mindful of we are singing songs of my success for particular productions, which were at least 10 years ago, well, almost 10 years ago, a couple of them, you know, and sort of thinking like I don't want to misrepresent myself, but I also think it's a worthwhile conversation to say, yeah, I sort of lost my way a little bit there. I needed to stop and breathe and go, I feel really overwhelmed. I feel really exhausted. What do I want to do? Do I want to do anything? But, oh, my God, if I don't want to do theatre, who am I and what do I have? So that's a whole bunch of stuff that I've been through, and I'm just finding my way back from that now, which is actually quite lovely. It's slow and steady. And, again, it's dependent on a committee of people and a particular artist who is writing and directing a new work for Dionysus right now, and I'm working alongside her. Mm. And my role is integral and important but supportive and guiding but not controlling or directing. And that's also very healthy for me and gives me that space. Anyway, so going – sorry, did you want to ask
Yeah, I do want to ask you something because that's an interesting thing for from a Creative Rumble perspective that you have gone full headlong, create. You are an innately creative person, individual.
Whether I want to be or not.
That's exactly right.
which is why it can be exhausting. The ideas don't stop. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't stop. And that is another crucial question. How, you know, something forced you to stop and then you've had to flip and re-find a new way of working. So, you know, so for the benefit of our audiences, we'll have audiences who don't think that they're creative, but then you know, I'm hoping there are listeners out there who have found themselves in that particular position where, and I found myself in that stage too of like, have I just pumped out everything that I've got? What do I do now?
Mm.
Do I even enjoy it? Maybe I just stop who I am. But that was who I was.
Mm.
What is that? So it's just this re-tapping back into oneself. So I'm curious if we could just sideline a little bit. Were there some strategies, you know, or how did you just to stop, to rethink, to fight, like, or is it just a matter of time and something has come to you that reignites something? What is that?
One thing we talk about, the creativity doesn't stop,
mm-hmm.
And this doesn't have to be a focus of the conversation today, but I feel it's relevant.
Mm.
So I'm nearly 50. I'm going to be 50 next year. So that's a fairly significant period of time and a life of experience. And because I'm Generation X, I'm someone.
Whoa.
Right. But again, I'm someone who will not be alone in this. But what was it? 3 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I actually went to my cycle and said, hey, because I was also as a teacher, you are then privy to an array of diversity and learning challenges and different ways you need to accommodate and modify for students. And I think it was like a little light bulb moment. I went to my cycle and went, hey, do I have ADHD? Am I on the spectrum? And we did a lot of work and then I was then subsequently referred to someone else. And yes, I'm not on the autism spectrum, but I absolutely have ADHD. Off the charts apparently might have been the phrase that was used. Anyway, and that's on one hand, as we know, it can be great to have a label because that can then afford you, research, information, actual understanding of what this means and what it looks like. But it's also incredibly overwhelming to go, my goodness, you know, if you are born into a time when we understand what something is, what it looks like, what the treatment is, what is a strategy, what is not a strategy, what we accommodate, what we guide through, then there'll still be challenges, but they are challenges that are forged and met in formative years. And to be, you know, in your mid-40s and suddenly go, oh, I wasn't crazy. I wasn't stupid. I wasn't unable to understand those concepts. You know,
it was I'm not unorganized.
That's right. I'm not in the wrong place with the wrong people. We've sort of talked about before that imposter syndrome, but even just I don't belong here. I don't match these people. And just as a side note, for anyone who has not just ADHD, but any significant diagnosis of a condition that will have been with you since birth or very early years, but because of where you have fallen within our societal timeframe, you don't become aware of that until much, much later. It is a very tough balance because you get to go, wow, okay, let's back. That's where that was. That reaction, that experience, that overwhelm, that's what that was. Let's break it down. And you are absolutely entitled to and should be afforded a moment of grief and sadness to go, oh, because I do that and go, oh, 12-year-old Emma, things would have been very different for her if there'd been more understanding and support as opposed to, and I don't use this phrase lightly, but a couple of times, like, what's wrong with you? Mm. What's wrong with you? That you know, embeds deep in a child's psyche, and there's a lot of that I still deal with today. And it wasn't said out of rejection or a lack of love, but a genuine confusion of this isn't what I'm used to. What is the problem here? Anyway, so, but you also can't lose yourself and dwell in that grief because it is what it is, but then, well, what are you going to do now? Don't let it stop. Like it's a gift to go, cool, well, I wasn't those things. We just didn't know that. So what can I do with it now? But then it's also very easy to get overwhelmed and exhausted with it. So a lot of things happened, you know, well, 2000, I mean, that's the kind of thing. We went into 2000, we went into lockdown. My father was put into care. And I was diagnosed with ADHD and there was a couple of other things as well. But I think that those three, like there's a whole worldview shift there. It's a real destabilizing moment. And I get another side note. We're doing lots of side notes. As I touched on with you this morning, I'm an incredibly independent person and I've also been quite individual for a lot of my life. Like I am head of drama at the college where I work. But while that is a valid title, I drive and lead all of the dramatic performing arts events. I write all of the drama curriculum. So that is an authentic title, but simultaneously it doesn't always feel right because I am mostly, like every now and then it's not the case, but predominantly for 98% of my career, I have been the only drama teacher in the school. So it's a title by default, but it doesn't change the reality of the work that I do and the role that I perform. So you've got me being the sole drama teacher. Now, writing curriculum is a huge thing. Designing and directing productions is huge. To not have a colleague or a collegial team, support or even a sounding board, that's very isolating. The company, at no point did I do that company on my own, but it was my company. So even when people helped out, I always felt, right or wrong, that they were doing me a favour. It felt like this building up this enormous amount of what I owed and needed to show gratitude for. And the responsibility fell on my shoulders. I'm an only child, which I have struggled with for much of my life and felt quite isolated in that regard. I live alone and I'm not in a relationship, which in theory I love and I'm happy with, but I haven't, especially particularly in recent years, I've gone, but that is a lot of solitude and it is better to not have that much solitude. So then, yeah, COVID, I love my home. My home is a sanctuary. Like it's called Hestia. She was the goddess of hearth and home, but she's also the origin of the word sanctuary, which is what I wanted. But then when I was in that home on my own I found it really difficult, which also destabilized me a bit because I'm like, but you're an independent person. You operate individually. But of course, we're not supposed to be completely on our own.
You can be independent.
Without being isolated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so I guess I just wanted to sort of, yeah, there can be a lot of that in my head about, yeah, so that's sort of what I was dealing with. That's sort of the challenges I faced in recent years that I'm now coming out of. Yeah, just sort of finding my feet as a creative within that company, which has now, because it was like, it was my company operating under my ABN as a sole trader, basically. And then recently we've moved to incorporated association, which was a huge shift for me to go, yeah, you know what, this isn't just mine. I don't just want my shot, but I want other people to be able to go, no, we are, this is also ours and we are invested in this, which on some levels could be very difficult for me going, well, there could be something that happens that I don't like or don't agree with and I could be overruled, and that's what has to happen because that's what a committee is. That's what a body of people.
Yeah.
But then also it's not just me. It's not all on me. And that's both good for someone who's nearly 50 and who is tired, but also healthy for someone who, whether she wanted to or not, there's enormous benefit and autonomy in being able to go, well, this is all on my shoulders, which means I can do whatever I want and I don't have to run it by anyone. Mm. So it's incredibly empowering, but it can also be problematic going, well, sometimes you do actually need to go, well, what do you want to do, and make room so that anyway. So,
well, I just want to say congratulations for doing that, moving into the incorporated. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it was really important for the company as well,
yes.
Especially because I want it to have longevity.
But that's that drawing in of community, you know, a community of artists who are building something.
And some of my best friends, my strongest friends and my most rewarding friendships have occurred through the company, people I've met through the company, and they continue to contribute to the company in ways I can't even articulate how incredible they are and how they've enriched the company and then my work as a creative as a result. But then that has also become friendship that moves outside. It's not just theatre and creativity and art. It's also personal connection and support. So it is, like, even when it was still, you know, the sole trader heading, it was still a community of people.
Yes.
But it was nice to, you know, mentally for me to formalise that and go, yes, well, it isn't just mine, it's ours.
Yeah.
And yours.
Yeah.
And, yeah, to also make sure those people didn't – also, I want them to do things and contribute things and not feel like, well, will Emma be okay with this? Well, are you the director of the show? Well, then that's your choice, you know.
So you're creating space for artists, for creatives to be creative, to build, to
– And on that, I suppose linking it back to book club, one of the great things of book club, like while I was a voracious reader and I read all sorts of stuff, there were still things where – I wouldn't say I was a book snob per se, but, you know, because you can't read every book that's ever written, you do have particular authors or styles, or you'd read the back of a book and go, yeah, I'm not going to like that. But with book club, you know, everyone contributes, everyone says, you know, we say, oh, you haven't suggested a book for, you know, 8 months. Why don't you choose the next month's book? And so you will pick up books and have to read books that you otherwise never would have picked up, and some of the best books I've read and some of the best authors I now know, not personally, are books that I would have read in a bookshop and put down. So it's marvellous to go, you have to be open to what someone else will bring to you. And that's been brilliant in book club. And so I had like almost the same experience of we had someone who was lined up to direct this year's main stage show. They were no longer able to do it, which was just one of those things in life. That's what happens. But then I'm like, oh, I don't want to do it. I just don't mentally feel ready to do it. And also given I'd be stepping in, it would be stressful and I'd feel like I was half-assing it and overwhelming myself. And I thought, oh, but who can I ask? And I went to a friend of mine who's acted, and she acted brilliantly in my production of The Trojan Women. And I said to her, and she's done other things, we've connected on other things. I said, hey, Rand, like really short, are you interested? And she goes, yes, actually, yes, I am. And she said, what would you want me to direct? I said, well, you're directing, you choose. I said, however, these are the kinds of things we've done, and we'll tap back into because she's done it like,
oh, okay, yep.
You know, and it's not a hard and fast, but Dionysus kind of had a sort of like, I suppose, a foundation of classic works recontextualized for a modern audience, all right? That's a very loose interpretation of a lot of what we did. So I said that to her. I said, that's not obligatory, but that's a good place to start. That's a very Dionysian sort of work concept. I said, but I'm open. Like, and I was very determined to be open. And initially said I'd like to write something. I went, oh, I'd rather not do, you know, we've got such a short time, I'd rather work with an existing work. Also from a, you know, we're building ourselves back up to after COVID. We want audiences to come and see our shows, and you often have a better chance if someone may not be coming to support Dionysus if they haven't heard of us or don't remember us or but, you know, a lot of people will go, oh, you're doing this, I like that play, or I like that play, we're irrelevant, like they'll go see that. Mm-hmm. So I'm also a bit reluctant to go, but if it's something no one's heard of, is that twice as hard for us to get an audience to it? And also the time frame. And she's like, no, that's fine. But then we went through a few bits and pieces, and then she came back and said, I'm really sorry, I know this isn't what you want, but this is an idea I've actually been playing around with for like 5 years. Mm. And she'd seen a documentary, and I won't go into too much detail, about the Lost Songs of St Kilda. So in the Hebrides, these outer islands in Scotland, there was a particular community that essentially lived on this island, completely isolated, completely self-sufficient. But as, you know, the world changes and society evolves, they were completely cut off, and therefore supplies getting to them, medical treatment, all these sorts of things happened. And eventually they requested to be evacuated, which, just take a moment to appreciate. Imagine if all you'd ever known were this tiny, tiny island and this, you know, very small group of people, and that's all you'd ever known, and you actually having to go, we won't survive if we stay here. Will you please take us away from the only home we've ever known? That in itself is a fascinating story. So that happened in the 1930s. This is like, I'm not doing this story any justice. I'm skimming across the most basic elements of it. And then jump forward several years, and a man, oh, I've forgotten his surname. His name's Stuart, and he works in IT and digital programming and things like that. And he was going around to aged care homes to meet residents and to help them perhaps record stories on a digital platform, so they were preserved, so they were, they were kept. So he was just doing that, and he went in one day, and there was this gentleman, again, I've forgotten the surname, I believe his name was Trevor, an elderly resident, and he was playing the piano, and he was playing these beautiful songs, and Stuart went, oh, what's that? And it turns out what he was playing is the Lost Songs of St Kilda. So this particular island was called St Kilda, and yes, the Melbourne suburb is named after the ship that was named after that island. And Trevor was playing these songs that he was a child when they were evacuated, and he was taught there was no recording of these folk songs from the islands of St Kilda, but people just knew to play them, and he learnt by fingers on his fingers teaching him how to play this music.
Oh, wow.
And so he, this one man, was the sole resource of this music, and had Stuart not met him at this time and gone, could we please record this music, that music would have been lost completely from history. So it's become, so if you want to look it up on YouTube and online, like the Lost Songs of St Kilda, they've now done, recorded the music, the album, it exists. So Katie had seen a documentary on that, and she was just fascinated. She wrote to Stuart and said, I'd actually like to tell this story. Stuart said, yes, Trevor passed away a few years ago, but Stuart now, you know, he guards the music. He's the caretaker of the Lost Songs of St Kilda. And so Katie was keen to write a work that delves into this story of these people, but also within the folklore, like looking at the history, this island, this space, the folklore. There's a lot of amazing folklore and mythology around these people and the land in which they lived. So sort of playing around with the idea of verbatim theatre and sort of literally creating a space for these characters or representation of these characters to tell their own story. There's ideally puppetry involved. And anyway, so she brought that to me. Now, that while that is beautiful, it is nothing like what I imagined, what I have necessarily directed ourselves to. And my first instinct was like, oh, no. And I went, what are you doing? Like, you know what? And also, you went to Katie for a reason. There is a reason why you went to her, because you trusted her.
What you said, what are you doing to yourself, not to her?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, just to be clear, yes. So, you know, like Katie brought me this idea, and there was no part of me going, oh, Katie, what are you doing? Oh, Katie, that shit. Mm. Not even remotely. It was purely like, oh, that's not what I saw for Dionysus. I don't think that's what Dionysus does. You know, that kind of thinking. And, yeah, that's what I said to myself, going, you know, like even though there was that sense of, oh, gosh, I've got to get someone, I still would have never tapped someone on the shoulder if I didn't have complete unwavering faith in their capacity to be amazing, or my, not even capacity of who they might be, like my knowledge that they already were amazing and they would only do amazing things. So I thought, Emma, you went to Katie for a reason. And Katie has danced, but she's come back going, no, actually this is a thing I've had in my head for years. And I went, then that's what we're supposed to do. This is the space, and this is what Dionysus should be. Katie, who has earned a place in a Dionysus space to create work has said, well, this is the work I want to create. And unless it is something we go, yeah, that's completely inappropriate or that's offensive or society is not ready for that, unless it is something within those realms, we go, all right, Katie, then that's the work you create. What do you need from us? And we've had several sessions, Katie and I together, and it's been exactly what I've needed. And it's been brilliant. It's been really brilliant and valuable. So, yeah, quite a shift. But also I like the idea that, well, and not diminishing the work I've done and the work I may yet do, but it's also very validating, I guess, but also warming to go, well, what if you also created Dionysus as a space for work that people might otherwise not have been able to produce, and they can bring it to you and go, well, could Dionysus do this? Could I please do this? Would Dionysus have space for me to do this? And go, yes, please, please do that. So that's exciting. That's an exciting
expansion of the brand, the scope.
Yeah.
Well, you know, but it's
a literal and figurative space, I guess, too.
But I love the fact that you're opening up to new work that has not.
Yeah, and imagine if I hadn't. You know, imagine if I've gone on, but Dionysus is this. Well, who says Dionysus is this? And again, well, officially Dionysus hasn't been that for about 4 or 5 years because we've been in a pandemic.
But also, can we just bring it back to like, okay, let's say Dionysus is just like, oh, no, you know, the simple everyday.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I don't do that. No. I don't do that because what if you do, as you said before?
Because it's storytelling.
Openness.
Yeah.
Someone bringing you something and being open to it.
But it also taps into what you were saying before, what we were both saying before about theatre being a conversation.
Mm.
And, well, actually, we started that and then I had thoughts in my head, which I don't remember now if I said them out loud or not. So it's the kind of thing where I go, remember we were talking about, like, no, we weren't talking about that. Oh, it was in my brain, sorry. theatre is a conversation where, and that's the amazing thing about theatre, any art, is, yes, an artist may have had a complete idea about what they wanted to do. And it can be very difficult as an artist to go, all right, well, I have created what I wanted to create, the way I wanted to create, to tell the message I wanted to tell, but now I have to step away. And look, if I've done a good job, the majority of consumers will get that message or part of that message or the core tenet of that message.
Mm.
But also not everyone will, and they might get their own stuff, and you have to be okay with that.
Mm.
Like, one of the ways I've had to let go is usually in the early years when I'd be directing work, like there'd be 1 to 2 pages of director's notes I'd put in a program going, this is why I did this and this is what that's about. And this is, and I'm like, well, no, let people work that out for themselves. Or even let them, they may not get exactly what you meant, but they may get something quite different, which is beautiful and amazing and then sparks their own journey or direction or conversation with other people about it. But if they'd read your director's notes, then that would be all they got from it.
Yeah.
And you're closing that idea in. So it's that same principle of going, well, who decides what Dionysus is and what it creates? Be comfortable that you've created a space, like the work that I've done and ergo the people that I have attracted and forged relationships with because of the work that I've done is the foundation for future work. And if it's something that I actually wouldn't have envisioned or I personally would have chosen to do, no worries, because it's still from that foundation that was forged. Now, like, that person wouldn't have come to this space and they wouldn't have shared that idea if they didn't feel like I said, I went to Katie because Katie's amazing and I have complete faith in her.
Mm.
But I'd like to think, well, and she was hesitant because I'd gone, oh, we need to do this, we need to do that. Mm. But she still did bring the idea. I feel really grateful. I'm thinking, well, there is still something there with me that even though I had potentially given her the indication that that idea probably wouldn't even be worth her time to bring to me, she kind of went, no, just hear me. Just, I know you probably won't say yes, but I just have to pitch. She still pitched it.
Mm.
And when she did, I went, oh, God, Emma, listen to you. Yes, yes, Katie, you have to do that idea. Yes, I support you.
Mm.
So I like the idea that I'm even more open now that I think some of these people will come to me and go, well, what about this idea? I've got this idea. What do you think? And I'll go, you know what? I wouldn't have thought of it, but I trust you. I value you. Let's bring that idea to life for you. And, yeah,
amazing.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's an interesting shift.
Very big shift. Hey listeners, we hope you're enjoying the Creative Rumble podcast.
If you're loving the content, why not share the podcast with someone who could use some creative inspiration?
We'd also love to hear from you. Drop us a note via our website or Instagram. Your feedback and stories make this podcast even better.
And if you want to support us further, get online to our website and click on the Buy Us a Coffee link. Your donation keeps the Creative Rumble alive.
You can find all the links in the show notes. Thank you for being a part of our creative community.
Until next time, keep rumbling.